This week on The Photographer's Perspective, we talk luminosity masks and post-processing with Sean Bagshaw. I've been fortunate to work alongside some of the world's most inspiring photographers. I've watched how they've helped others at our conferences and transform the way they see through the lens. Welcome, I'm your host, Chris Smith, founder of Out of Chicago. This is F8, The Photographer's Perspective, the show where we have candid conversations and go in-depth with the pros to get to know them better. Join us each week as we discuss photography, get to know their personal perspectives, and introduce you to new places and experiences, helping you get the most out of your creative passion. All right, I'm here with the Sean Bagshaw. Welcome to the podcast, Sean.
Hey, Chris, thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I mean, we just had you as one of our photographers at the Out of Oregon conference, which turned out great. You were an amazing instructor. And tell us a few of the things you were teaching there.
Well, that was a great conference. That's the first one of your conferences I've had the pleasure to go to. And I just loved it. It was spectacular. Everything, the whole format, the organization, the locations, all the people, it was just great.
Thank you.
Had a great time. Keep up the good work with that. I was teaching, you know, the usual stuff that I seem to teach about, a lot of image developing stuff, some stuff with luminosity masks, kind of extended dynamic range and exposure blending, and some techniques for trying to get the most drama and impact out of your landscape photos.
Yeah, that's some of what I want to talk about too, kind of the post-processing you do. You're known for your luminosity masks and the videos that you've got on your YouTube channel and all the tutorials and that, along with the great landscape photography that you do. But I want to talk some about, you know, kind of the why of what you do. So maybe we get into that a little bit. Like, you know, first off, like why would someone, what is a luminosity mask? Why would someone need one? And then we'll get into a little bit more in that.
Okay, so...
You don't mind, do you? Like, we have nothing figured out for what we're talking about, so we're just going to assume that this is perfect.
We're just going to ride the roller coaster here. Anything related to any sort of techniques in Photoshop or photography, I mean, I'm a photographer, but I really have kind of ended up being a photography educator in my career. And so anytime I get a chance to talk about the stuff I do and how I do it, I love that. So.
Yeah, luminosity mask. We should say that you were a middle school science teacher. Is that right? Before this?
That's correct. Middle school science. And you were high school science,
right? That's right. That's right. I taught physics. You taught just all science?
Yeah, all science. Middle school curriculum. So we had to cover it all. So I had to be slightly knowledgeable in all areas of science.
Yeah, no, that's good. I guess people are always asking me questions about like biology and whatever. I'm like, I haven't had biology since I was in ninth grade. Like, right. I didn't do that. Yeah. So, but I think that that's a huge part of what makes you such a great instructor is that that's your background. And I think that we find that with so many of the people that, that do our events, the instructors that we have, that their specialty, what they're really known for is not necessarily even their photography, that what makes them do so well is something that they've had as a prior experience. Like some of the people that do so well on their YouTube channels, well, it turns out they were a video producer in a prior life or whatever. So there's that. So yeah, let's get into a little bit. You really are known now as a great teacher of photography and these post-processing techniques. So tell us a little bit about kind of your thing.
Well, we started off talking a little bit about luminosity masks, and you asked the question, you know, first of all, what are they and why would anybody want to utilize them in their image developing? So the first part of that question, what are luminosity masks? They're really, it's something that is in Photoshop. It's a capability that Photoshop has always had, as far as I know, going back to at least the 90s when I started messing around with Photoshop. And really, it's no different than any other type of mask. And one of the things that makes Photoshop so powerful is the ability to use layers of masks. That's what enables you to do things in Photoshop that you can't do in a lot of other image editing software. So masks are what enable us to see part of what's on one layer and part of what's on a separate layer. So in that way, you can combine different elements from different layers within the image. And so a mask does that. And also, if you do an adjustment, a mask controls where you see the adjustment and where you don't see the adjustment. So luminosity masks are just masks, but they control what you see from one layer to the next layer, or from what you did in an adjustment based on the luminosity values in the image. So if you want to make an adjustment that only goes to the bright luminosity values, then you would use a luminosity mask to target that adjustment just to your highlights. Same with shadows or midtones. So that's the basics.
So when you say luminosity, I mean, that sounds like a really fancy thing, but it's really just a matter of how bright it is, correct?
That's all it is. Yeah. So when you're creating a mask in Photoshop, a lot of masks are generated from selections. In fact, selections are just two different sides of the same thing. So if I make a circular selection and turn it into a mask, then I'll have a mask that's black outside the circle and white inside the circle. That's like a really super basic mask. So luminosity masks are just masks that are made from a luminosity selection. So the pixels are all selected based on their luminosity values. The brighter they are, the more they get selected, and therefore the more they are, those tones appear in the mask, and the more you target the adjustment to those tones.
So what's the main purpose behind it? What are you trying to get out of what you're creating here?
What it does is it really doesn't, I mean, you're still doing all the same sorts of adjustments that you could do in Photoshop anyway, but sometimes you want to be able to create a very nuanced or very subtle or very a selection that has imperceptible boundaries to it. And that's where the control of a luminosity mask comes in. So for example, if I wanted to darken the highlights, I could try to hand paint on my mask those highlights, or I could draw a circle around the highlights, but then you'd see the edge of that circle, where the adjustment starts and stops. If I hand painted it, I'm a lousy painter and I'm not very patient, so that would look really bad as well. So the luminosity mask allows you to make that adjustment in a very targeted way, but a very imperceptible and subtle way. So it's really just the same kind of adjustments that anyone in Photoshop is doing anyway, but with the kind of control and nuance that you can't get with a lot of other techniques.
And what kind of tools do you need to have in Photoshop to be able to pull something like that off?
Well, like I said a little earlier, the ability to work with luminosity selections, luminosity masks in Photoshop has, I think, been there since the beginning. It actually is it's a digital version of a process that was used in screen printmaking back in the analog days when you're doing, like silk screening and that kind of stuff, I guess. So they built these color channel masks into Photoshop so that they could reproduce that kind of technique digitally. That was what initially it was there for. So you can actually do luminosity mask stuff without anything other than Photoshop, but you have to know where to go find these things in Photoshop. It's not like a lot of things where there's a tool in the toolbox or a panel or anything like that for it. And so the process of making luminosity masks by hand manually is kind of convoluted and backdoor, and it's also really time consuming and tedious. And the reality is no one would be doing them by hand other than the most very basic, simple luminosity masks. So most people who are using them use some sort of custom extension panel. And the one I use and the one that I teach is Tony Kuiper's TK panel, which is, as far as I know, the one that's been around the longest. Tony put out the very first version of his panel in 2006, so 13 years ago, almost 14 years ago.
Yeah, so, and some people might not even know what you mean, a panel, but it's just like where you'd see like the tone curves, the saturation and all that. It's just its own part to that that people can bring up, and it's got, what kind of things are people going to select from there when they're trying to create their luminosity mask? Just a basic idea, sorry.
Yeah, no, with Tony's panel, and I can't speak to, and there are a lot of other panels out there, and I haven't used other ones, so I can't exactly speak to those. But the TK panel actually has two main modules. One module is kind of a controller command center for all the things in Photoshop that photographers do frequently, all the time. Kind of puts all those things right there in one spot for you, easy access. The other module is the one that makes the luminosity mask. And so in that module, if you're making luminosity masks, the first thing you do is you select a source. So where is the luminosity mask going to come from? Is it going to come from a composite luminosity channel, the red channel, the green channel, the blue channel? Is it going to actually not be a luminosity mask? You can make also color range masks, saturation masks. There's a lot of different types of these types of luminosity or masks that I think a lot of people just refer to them all as luminosity masks, but technically they're not all luminosity masks. So you choose a source first, then you choose the mask. What is it going to be? A lights mask, a darks mask, a midtones mask. Then you can modify the mask if you want to make it customized, or if you want to make the mask only be in one part of the image, you can do that. And then the last thing you do is you output the mask. You say, okay, I want this mask output to a curves adjustment layer or a saturation adjustment layer, or I want this mask output to that pixel layer that I already have there. So that's basically how it works.
Yeah, so that's the next question, is everything you're saying almost up to this point till the very end was just like to make that mask, but then what are those adjustments that you're making after that? And why do you make certain adjustments?
So a lot of it for me is tonal control. So I'm trying to get all the tones in my image to work how I want them to. So I may want my shadows a little darker or not so dark. I may want my highlights a little darker, or I may want certain highlights to be really brilliant and pop, you know, specular highlights. I may want to add contrast into the midtones. So those are the kinds of adjustments that I'm doing with these masks. So for example, if I want to add contrast in the midtones, I make a midtones mask that's going to target the middle tones in the image. And then I could put that on a brightness and contrast adjustment layer and use that to add contrast, but just into the midtones. And when I'm doing that just in the midtones, I'm now not blowing out my highlights or blocking up my shadows because the mask is protecting those and it's only allowing the midtones to be affected.
Interesting. Will you sometimes then change that mask later? Do you know what I'm saying? Like adjust things that are a little bit brighter, actually, like don't change what that brightness and contrast change was, but change where the mask, what it's affecting after you've already made that adjustment.
You can do
Does
that
make sense?
Totally. Yeah. So you can go back to masks and modify those masks after the fact. You can use other masking techniques. So for example, you'd start with a luminosity mask, but then you can paint with just a paintbrush on the luminosity mask to, you know, modify it that way. You can work with luminosity masks with any of the types of tonality adjustments. So for example, I could open up a curves adjustment on a luminosity mask if I wanted to make the luminosity mask have greater tonal separation. I want to make the bright areas in the mask brighter and the dark areas in the mask darker. I could do a curves adjustment to the mask itself. So yeah, lots of things you can do to masks after the fact if you didn't get it just how you wanted it the first time.
I hate to say this, but like, what are your rules? Where do you draw the line so that you don't go too far? How do you know when you've gone too far with your post-processing? Because that's, especially for people that are just starting out, it's one of the most difficult things to figure out on your own.
Right. Yeah, that is. And that's one of the reasons why I work with Photoshop the way I do with these layers, because I build up my adjustments very gradually and incrementally, and each individual adjustment is a very slight, small adjustment. And a lot of times it's an adjustment to one very small area of the image, or one very narrow tonal range within the image, or one very narrow color range within the image. And so I'm slowly building up small adjustments. So how do you know when you've gone too far? I do a lot of coming back and not, you know, taking time, building up those adjustments. I think it looks great, but let it sit, go away, come back later. Sometimes out, you know, just an hour or two, and I can see things that I didn't see before, or it just really stands out to me that I took it too far. Sometimes it's days, and sometimes I'll think something looks great for a couple of years, and then I'll look back at an image and think, wow, my sensibilities have completely changed over those last couple of years. I don't like this anymore, even though I used to. Also looking at it, I look at a lot of different devices. So, you know, my big monitor that I use on my desktop computer, I'll load it onto my phone and see what it looks like on a phone. I run test prints when I can a lot, seeing how it looks in print. So a lot of that gives me information about if I think it's how I intend it to be, or if it is too much for me.
So will you save like the full Photoshop file so that 2 years later when you're like, whoa, what was I thinking back then? You could just change a couple layers, or do you start from the beginning again?
No, I definitely save all of my adjustment layers, all the layers that I can save. I save those just for that exact reason. So I can go back. Yeah, there's never a time when I open an image that I've developed previously that I don't go in and make some sort of fine-tune adjustments. It almost always happens. And also, I have some images that I have that I love, and I've tried to go back and develop them again later, and I can't recreate. I can't remember what I did, or I just,
yeah,
for whatever reason, that. I can never get it back to that, you know.
I've done that, and unfortunately, I've also done that while I was teaching classes, and they're like, oh, that looks great. I'm like, well, let me show you what I did. And they're like, well, that's not right. I'm like, no, it's not right. That's not good at all. And I can't get it back to what I did before. Yeah, no, I hear you. What about, you know, I feel like if you're on Facebook, if you're on social media, you're seeing a lot of things nowadays, different software programs that are saying, hey, you can get some awesome shots with one click of a button. What do you think about that kind of thing?
I think when it comes to photography, I really encourage everyone to find out, you know, what floats your boat? What makes photography fun for you?
Well, I'm going to interrupt you for a second, because I should have started the whole podcast by saying, I think Sean Bagshaw may be the nicest guy in all of photography. And so he's not going to say anything mean, but I will let you continue your thought. Go ahead.
It's true. There's enough negativity out in the world, I think. Maybe that's why I'm so nice, or maybe my parents just raised me right or something. I don't know.
So there's a lot of things out there. They're like one click and your picture's going to be perfect. We know how to write the software to make that happen. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are if that's what you want to do and that gives you the final image that you're happy with and that just makes you love photography, then you should do that. For me, that's not how I want to do my photography. I love the developing process, and I love having as much control and nuance and ability to be creative as I can get. And that's Photoshop. And there's other great applications out there that have a lot of control, like Photoshop. Then there's some that give you kind of middle ground in terms of kind of how easy or intuitive it is compared to how much control you have. And then, like you said, there's some of that stuff out there that's very basic and simple, kind of one click, sort of, you know, applying a filter in one click or just editing the whole image in one click. To me, that takes all of the fun out of it for me and all of the creativity and the artistry, because I'm really trying to instill a little piece of myself into my images. Like when you see my image, one of my images, it's not the image my camera took. Because that camera, no matter who held that camera, it's going to take an image. Cameras don't create anything. They just record. So I want to, put some of me in my photos. And I feel like if I'm just clicking someone else's presets, that's not really me. Guess that's when it comes down to me. But I know there's a lot of people out there that don't want to spend that kind of time. Or not interested. That's not where the fun is, or that's not where the creative part is for them.
Yeah. They say, I don't want to spend time in front of the computer. I want to be out shooting. Yeah. But I'm kind of in the same boat as you. I want to enjoy shooting, but then it's a creative process after that as well. I totally agree with you. But Everyone's got their own thing. I absolutely agree with that too.
I get all excited when I'm out in the field. You know, when I'm taking a photo, I start getting all kind of stoked for, oh, I know what I'm going to work on. You know, I get the vision in my head and like, oh, when I get, this is going to be like a good 2 or 3 hours when I get home. I can't wait.
All right. I'm going to ask you a question then that goes along with my biggest pet peeve in all of photography. And that is, so let's say that that's happened to you and we're walking back to the car. I'm like, Sean, you think you got any good shots? What's your answer? He's trying to answer this so he doesn't get my pet peeve.
I probably almost always say, yeah, probably. I'm a fence sitter in everything until something is shown to be true. Because I just know from experience, there's so many times where I walk away thinking, oh man, that was the photo session of a lifetime. That's going to be my, that's going to be my defining image. It's going to come from that shoot. And then I get back home and just, there's nothing there that I, you know, that really excites me or doesn't quite live up to what it was in my head because of whatever that experience was or who knows what. And then so many other times when I've walked away from a shoot feeling like, nah, that really didn't work out. Some of my best shots, I go back and find them in there that for whatever reason in the moment didn't really speak to me. So yeah, I'm always kind of hold my cards close and don't try to claim anything until I know later.
Yeah, I mean, what made me think of it though is that like the way you're saying, like, oh man, I can't wait to get back into to work on these images, and that's kind of how I feel sometimes. And maybe that's how I should change my question. You got some stuff that you're excited to work on, you know, and see if you got something good. It's always my pet peeve when I ask people and they go, well, I have no idea until I get back on the computer. I was like, what do you mean you have no idea? Like that's what can drive me nuts.
But, I see.
But of course, sometimes you'll think you got the best thing and it turns out that it wasn't quite what I thought.
No, I always have an idea. Yeah. And I'm, again, being a positive minded person, I usually in my mind, I may not say it out loud, but in my mind, I think I've got something amazing and I can't wait to work on it. But it's more the idea that I get to go work on it and it may or may not end up being good. But just this idea that now I have something I can go, I have a project.
Yeah, exactly. What about, I'm probably going to get the same answer I got on the other one. One click, you know, your picture's perfect type of thing. What about, hey, it was a bad sky. I'm going to put a different sky from something else in there, or software that one click and it's going to replace the sky. Same thoughts on that?
Well, for sky replacement specifically, you know, that's not something that I frequently do. I would say that's probably something I've done in a couple of images over 20 years of photography. Very few. There's been a couple where I felt like whatever the scene was so great, and that something about the sky was all that needed to get me to an image that was really something I thought was special. And by working with a different sky, that would get me there, then yeah, I'll do it. For me, it's about the experience, I guess. So if I didn't experience an amazing sky, I'm not that interested in a photo of a sky that I didn't experience. Now, when I have an amazing sky, then absolutely, I want to, you know, bring that out, really showcase that as much as I possibly can. But yeah, when I walk, I rarely walk away from a shoot where the light and the sky wasn't interesting, thinking, yeah, I'm really pumped to work on that image, even though it was blah. I'll figure it out. I'll make it look amazing. Now, there's plenty of people that do that. And I think that's amazing. When I see really good photo illustrators, really good composite artists who not only can imagine and get excited about a different sky, but really every element of an image. I see images that don't exist. They came entirely from inside that person's brain. They conceptualized it and put it together. I just think some of that artwork is so amazing. I don't have that sort of conceptual ability. You know, I'm very literal and it's all about the experience I had. And if I didn't have a good experience, I don't really have great ideas.
Yeah, and that's how I feel, is it's about the experience. And to me, I kind of draw that line, like, I don't ever want to create an image and someone come up and go, man, that sky was amazing, and go, well, actually, it wasn't when we were there. It kind of sucked. Yeah. You know, right. I just don't want that to happen. So I don't mind taking what's good and making it even better, as you're saying. But yeah, that's kind of tough to do something that totally wasn't there at all.
And I'm going to go back to the other part of your question, though, is what about software that can do that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to say that for me, if I was working that way, if I was doing photo illustration and composite work, it would be the same thing as what I said. It's like, I would be doing that because I like doing it and it's something that I want to put some of myself into it. And so I want to have the most control as possible. So I would want to, again, go into Photoshop and just do it myself. And even if there was software where I could one click it, I probably wouldn't use it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, I'm pretty sure you've agreed, there's no going back now, that you're going to come to Acadia with us this year, out of Acadia. No.
If that's out there, I'm definitely in for Acadia.
No. It's like you're it's all official. You're on the list. Like, awesome. You better not back out now.
No, I'm in.
So this will be the second time we'll have done out of Acadia, and it was amazing the first time. Have you been there before?
I have not been. You know, I am such a West Coaster that my East Coast experience is really limited. That's one of the things that has me particularly excited about this, is because that's all new territory for me.
And I think that's a great thing. We have a lot of people like in our surveys or just talk to me and they say, you know, you really just got to pick all people that just know the area so well that like back of their hand. But to me, like when we had Nick Page come out and he did Acadia, he'd never been there, but he was so excited to go to these places, you know, to bring that excitement and to bring the skills that Nick has. Same thing with you, to bring the skills that you have in post-processing and apply them to something new. I'm really excited. Obviously, we have a ton of people that do know Acadia really well, and we'll help you make sure we get you to the right spots and everything. But yeah, it's going to be really good. I'm just looking at the list of people and it's just going to be phenomenal. I mean, we have Colleen Minnick. She wrote The Photographer's Guide to Acadia. Mark Denny, who was with us in Oregon. Aaron Bobnick, who was with us in Oregon and Acadia and is part of your Photo Cascadia group, which we'll talk about in a minute. But we also have Francesco Gola. Do you know this guy?
Ooh, I know his work. It's beautiful.
Yeah. He's a great guy. I met him when we were in Spain at the Photo Pills camp, and he's going to be coming from Italy. Tony Sweet will be there. Hans, Alex Noriega, another guy that I met in Spain, Albert Dross from the Netherlands.
Yeah.
Matt Payne, I think you were on his podcast, will be there. Mike Taylor, who's in Acadia, I mean, he lives right near there. Ben Williamson, who is the staff photographer for Down East Magazine in Maine. Ann Belmont is doing flower photography in the gardens. Sarah Marino will be there, and Joshua Snow. So and Sean Bagshaw. So,
oh my gosh, what a awesome lineup that is. That's going to be really superlative. I'm going to say that's quite a group.
Right. What did you find when you're doing your workshops or when you were helping people on the Oregon coast? What are some of the things that you can really help people with when you're like down on the beach? And that you just can't really get across in some of your YouTube videos or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's especially important with coastal photography because I think that the kind of the fact that everything's in motion when you're on the shore, I think people are surprised at how you can, you know, where you need to place yourself, I guess. You know, it's like water and cameras don't mix, but really I think some of the most exciting coastal photography is just like flower photography. You know, get down close to the flowers, fill the frame. It's the same thing with waves and water motion, is getting close, you know, walk out in it, get your feet wet, move around. Of course, you have to be safe and careful and watch for, you know, never turn your back to the ocean, all that kind of stuff. But there's just so much potential there because it's constantly changing, constantly moving. It's this fluid thing. You can work with different shutter speeds. Every different shutter speed creates a different image. And those are all things that are difficult to teach without actually being in the environment. And also difficult to conceptualize because we're so used to a lot of landscape photography being very static. And so it doesn't matter what shutter speed you use. It doesn't matter how long you take to set up your shot because, you know, that rock's not going anywhere. So the ocean, completely different and really something you gotta, I think, experience. And having someone that can say, hey, you know what, if you stand back there, that's one thing, but here, let's wade up into, you know, ankle deep water and see what happens. And they're like, wait, what? We're gonna take our camera out in the water? Yeah, let's do this. You know, let's get out there.
Right, because if you're by yourself and you're like, man, I don't think I really should do that. But if you're with someone that's done it before, they know the area, they're comfortable, they know what to do, then you're a little more willing to take risks and be like, I didn't even realize that that's what you had to do to get these types of shots. That's pretty crazy. Yeah. So yeah, that's, I mean, you do workshops on your own. I think you told me when we came on here, they're all sold out for 2020, right? But yeah, tell us about the stuff that you do on your own too.
Yeah, well, I do a variety of workshops and photography tours in different places around the world. It's not the main part of my business, but I love being able to get out and interface with people and teach live. You know, I do a lot of my teaching through video, online video tutorials, and that's just me in my basement talking to myself or talking to my computer. So for me, it's really good to get out and have one, you know, actual interface with real people. So I work generally for workshops. I work with other people. I am not someone who's good at like the administration and the organizing, that's your specialty, Chris.
I'm trying.
But, you know, for me to figure out, okay, you know, how many hotel rooms do we need, or where should we eat, or even just getting all the right permits and that kind of stuff. There's a lot of work there. So I find people who are good at that. People like yourself, people like Aaron Bobnick, David Cobb, my friend Christian Heeb, who has the Cascade Center of Photography, and some other people that I've worked with over the years that set all that stuff up. And then I get to go along and be camera guy, be, you know, Photoshop, which is really awesome. So like in this last couple of years, I've done winter workshops in the Dolomites in Italy with Aaron. I do stuff all over the Northwest with David Cobb. I've also done Slovenia and Croatia with David Cobb. I've done Switzerland and Patagonia and Easter Island with Christian Heeb. So stuff just kind of all over the place. I do maybe two or three or four per year. Cause that's plenty.
So the main part of your business is the tutorials that you sell. Is that right?
Yeah. The
you said earlier that was not your main part of your business. So there must've been an answer that is the main part of your business.
The bulk of my income comes from online education. So that's kind of the bread and butter. And it was funny, when I started photography, that was not my plan. I was going to make my money selling, you know, fine art prints and, you know, having my photographs and magazines and that kind of stuff, which I definitely do. But the need and the interest in education, combined with my kind of past experience as a teacher, just kind of guided me towards, you know, that was where the need was. That's where the ability to make a good income was in education. But then the online education allows me to reach a worldwide audience, reach far more people more affordably. You know, there's a lot of people that, you know, that don't have an income to go on a week-long workshop or come to an Outer Chicago conference, or, you know, I've got customers in, you know, South America, Africa, India, parts of Asia that have very minimal budgets and incomes, but they can usually, you know, come up with 30 or 40 bucks for an online course. And that, to them, that's what they can do. And that's, so I like being able to be accessible to more people that way. Also.
So are these courses always available, or is they kind of come and go type of thing? Like if we go to your site now, could we purchase a bunch of them?
Oh yeah. Yeah. They're all up there. I mean, my old crappy ones that have gotten out of date, or when I started, I was really, really bad at it. Also, those are not there anymore.
It's the only way to get good at it though.
Yeah. No one would want those. So at this point, but they're there. Yeah. So I have, probably, I think, five or six courses that are there right now. And I'm always working on new ones, kind of retiring old ones and adding new ones in. I can only produce about three or four new courses in any given year. It takes me anywhere from a month to 6 weeks to fully do the whole production and everything. So, and then when I'm traveling, and then I'm also speaking at conferences and things like that, and also trying to take photos. So three or four new courses a year is a stretch.
Tell me a little more about Photocascadia. You mentioned some of the people that are part of it. What is it? Where did it start?
So Photocascadia is seven photographers. It's including myself, plus Adrian Klein, Kevin McNeil, Zach Schneff, Chip Phillips, David Cobb, Aaron Bobnick, who we've already talked about. And did I get seven there? Well, I hope I'm not leaving anybody. I think I got everybody.
And you.
Anyway, you can go to photocascadia.com, and we're all listed right on there. You can see all the members. And it is basically just a we call it a photography team, but that's a pretty loose definition. Really, it's a group of friends that we all have similar interests. We're also all kind of based in more or less the Northwest part of the United States. And it's great on many levels. It's a social group, it's a support group, it's a educational group. We teach each other, we share, we work together. You know, a lot of our workshops are done in pairs. We partner up to do workshops. We work on things like book projects together. We write a blog, which we've been writing. This is our 10th year. We've been doing it for a decade now. And so that blog, someone's supposed to write an article every week. So we don't always make that deadline, but for 10 years of having an article a week, there's a big backlog of pretty amazing photography content there. Photo Cascadia is just a great group. It's not a business in itself. We all have our own individual businesses. It's just a place where the seven of us who are very like-minded and enjoy working together, and we get along well, and we're good support for each other, kind of all come together and then hopefully share that enthusiasm and experience with the rest of the photo world.
Yeah, and it sounds like something that other people could do a similar type of thing. I feel that there's a lot of people out there that are kind of waiting, like, oh, I hope that I'm invited to be part of this, or I think that I should be a part of this or whatever, but start your own thing. And that's kind of what you guys did, right? So, yeah.
Exactly. And there have been other groups like that. I think maybe, I don't know if it's the original, but the one I think most people know about, the F64 group, going back to, Ansel Adams, Imogen Cunningham, I think Edward Weston and four or five others maybe, had the F64 group back in the day, and they were kind of the originators of that kind of photo team, I think. When we started Photo Cascadia, there were a couple others out there. I think one was called Time Chasers, Time Catchers, Light Chasers, something like that. It was people like Adam Gibbs, Mark Adamus, I think maybe Ian Plant maybe Ian Plant wasn't, I can't remember. There was another one called Mountain Trail, and that was more the East Coast folks, Joe Rosbach, Ian Plant, although I think Guy Town might have been that one. So there were some other groups when we started. We just started ours because we were a group of friends, and actually Aaron wasn't in the group at that point. It was the six of us. Adrian started it. We all knew each other, and he just said, hey guys, what do you think about this? And we said, yeah, sounds great. Let's do it. Sounds like fun. We brought in Aaron a few years later because a lot of people pointed out to us, we were a bunch of dudes and we still are a bunch of white dudes. But finding diversity in photography and landscape photography in the Pacific Northwest is definitely some of a challenge. But we brought in Aaron, like I said, a few years later, because first of all, we were huge fans of her photography before we knew her. We didn't know she was from this part of the country. In fact, we thought she was Slovenian. Because right. At the time she was posting everything from Slovenia. She actually lived in Slovenia, and she had this kind of online pen name that wasn't her actual name, which it was actually Greek, but none of us speak Greek. So we just assumed it was a Slovenian name. And eventually we met her and found out, oh, wait, you're from Northern California. And that led to eventually, because she is such a good photographer, such a good educator, and such a good writer, that we said, man, she's a perfect fit for the group.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of the articles she's done with you guys are just, the stuff that's in there, it's just so perfect and so different than anything else. I think that's kind of what makes Aaron special sometimes, is it just feels like it's not like a rehash of something else. It's like, I never even thought of it that way before. So
that is exactly what we said.
Yeah. Love Aaron. F8, the Photographer's Perspective, is brought to you by Out of Chicago. Out of Chicago brings together passionate enthusiasts with world-class photographers all in one epic location where you learn and shoot side-by-side with the pros. Since 2014, we've organized hands-on photography conferences in Chicago, New York City, Moab, and more. We are all photographers ourselves, so we understand what it takes to be inspired, get to the right place at the right time, and live our best creative life. What's the deal with the Columbia River Gorge? Totally off topic here.
Let's go that direction.
Yeah, let's do that one. No, I just wrote down all this stuff, but you guys are the Photo Cascadia, the whole area. Like the fires there, a lot of these areas that were so popular with photographers, they'll never be the same again. Is that right?
That is my understanding. We have had a lot of fires in the Northwest the last bunch of years. Kind of everywhere, but there was one in particular right in the Columbia Gorge. It was started by a kid who was throwing fireworks into the dry forest in the summer, right on probably the premier, most popular trail, the Eagle Creek Trail. So the fire basically started at ground zero in the Columbia Gorge and spread from there, and burned most of the really scenic trails and waterfall areas in the Columbia River Gorge. And to my knowledge, most of those trails, two or three years later, are still not open because they're not safe. Because burning all of that, all the trees and all the ground cover, now a lot, because it's very steep terrain in there. It's very loose and unstable, and it's landsliding almost constantly. So they're slowly working to get the plant life to grow back, to stabilize the soil, and then going to do all sorts of evaluations on the ecosystem and, you know, when is it ecologically wise to have people tromping around in there again, as well as safe. And I think, you know, more and more of it's going to come back open in time. But certain things, so like Punch Bowl Falls was kind of the one of the crown jewels of that. It's never coming back because not only did it burn, but after the burn, with the soil being exposed that winter, there was a huge landslide. And basically the Punch Bowl at Punch Bowl Falls is just filled in with a mountain of rubble. So yeah, that one's never coming back, or at least not in any way that we recognize.
The way that it was, yeah, that whole thing's a bummer. We could go down this list with a lot of other different things, but since I kind of started the lightning round and started all things all over the place, how about this one? How about,
I love it.
Where did you and I meet?
We met in Iceland at Kirkjufell.
That's right. You were there with Josh Merrill and Rainer, right?
Yeah, Rainer Sierwinski.
Yeah, and you guys had just been to, what am I trying to say? Before you came to Iceland, you went to...
Oh, we've been in the Faroe Islands. Yeah, we spent a week in the Faroe Islands. It was a great adventure. And then I think you and I had communicated online a couple of times, you know, leading up to that. But I had no idea what you look like. I'm not assuming you didn't know what I look like, but Josh Merrill, who's he lives in Chicago.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So you're familiar with Josh. So we'd all kind of been in the area, I think, photographing for a while. And all of a sudden Josh looked up and said, Chris?
Like, exactly.
Josh? Yeah. And I was like, wait, Chris Smith?
Wait, Sean Bagshaw?
introductions. Yeah, it was great.
That was great. Yeah. Then we had some beers and yeah, it was a good time.
Yeah. If I remember right, you grabbed the tab for beers.
Yeah. I said, this is my chance to be nice to Sean Bagshaw. So yeah.
Very nice. That was our first or second night in Iceland. And what no one told me is that beers in Iceland are like $15 a beer.
I don't remember that, but
I think you picked up the tab for I don't know how many beers. So I found that out later and I felt really bad.
No, I think out of Chicago got it. I mean, I think it's all good. Yeah. Yeah. Good times. How did you meet Josh?
I met Josh through Rainer. So I met Rainer previously. So Rainer meets a lot of people. Rainer has a gallery. He lives in Crested Butte, Colorado, and he has a gallery there. And so photographers being photographers love to go into other people's photo galleries and, you know, see what they're doing and meet other photographers. So that's how I met Rainer. I was in Crested Butte and I just went into his gallery and struck up a conversation with him. I was with Zach Schnepp from Photo Cascadia. And Rainer is the nicest guy. And immediately, he's the local guy in Crested Butte, or one of the local guys. He immediately just said, hey, guys, okay, so go here, go there. Here's this place that I love to photograph. Just shared lots of great information with us. Said, if you can come back in a couple nights, I have some time off. I'll take you out to this other place I know that you'd never find on your own. Let's have dinner. So we just hung out with Rainer, and that was great. And I've been back out to Crested Butte a few times to go photographing and mountain biking with Rainer out there. And it's just awesome. And I think Josh met Rainer the same way. And so Rainer and I were planning this trip to the Faroe Islands for, I don't know, a couple, 3 years. And at one point he said, hey, I've got this guy, Josh Merrill, who I want to invite on the trip. What do you think about that? And I said, if he's a friend of yours, he's a friend of mine. So Josh came, and that was where I met Josh, was on that trip. And I love Josh. He's a great guy also.
Yeah, he is. And he's kind of the opposite story where it's like everyone's making their way by teaching in that. And he's doing art fairs like crazy. And, you know, we've tried to have him at a lot of our things. He's like, nope, art fair that weekend, art fair that weekend. And that's how he makes it happen. And it's super impressive. And I've been to see him at a couple of them. And he's got quite the display when he does that. So good for him.
Yeah, absolutely. Good for him. It's hard work. He's a younger guy than me. So I'm, you know, good for him to get that done while he has the energy. Yeah, I think after we, about a week after we got back from that Faroe Islands, Iceland trip, Josh started that year his art show circuit.
The circuit.
And he said, yep, he was doing 23 weekends in a row. From, it was like early or mid-May all the way into October or something. And he'd be on the road doing those shows every weekend, which is awesome. But he actually sells his photographs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. He's a photographer that makes his money from his photographs. Crazy, right? Yeah. But yeah, he does a great job.
Yeah. People should definitely go check out Josh Merrill's website if you want to see some great photography. He's a wonderful photographer, which I think he's just Josh Merrill Photography.
I'll put links in the show notes. Yep.
Yeah. And then Rainer shoots medium format film. We call him the hipster, kind of analog hipster guy, because he's shooting this medium format film, but does amazing film work. And he's Lucid Landscapes. It is Rainer Sawinski, if you look him up online, because no one can spell Rainer's last name.
No, I'm not even sure I could say it. That's good. All right, last one. So I'm always thinking this way for myself. Like, I don't even know the right way to ask this question, but like, what are your like dreams? Like 10 years from now, the kids are off, they're doing their own thing. You can do whatever you want. Like, what do you see for yourself as a photographer? What do you see yourself doing? And do you see yourself even doing like a different type of photography or going in a different direction? What's up in that head of yours?
Boy, well, I try not to put too many constraints on what the future might look like, because if I tried to imagine 15 years ago what it would look like, what I'm doing right now, I never would have been able to predict this particular scenario. But I think I am just so happy with, I mean, I'm really fortunate. I'm grateful and thankful every day that I love my life and I love what I get to do. And I have so many interests. So I think in 10 years from now, I think my life hopefully looks pretty similar to what it looks like now. But with a few caveats, first of all, the kids are out of the house. I see them on holidays and some weekends and things, which is awesome. And then the rest of the time, it just opens up more time for me to do the kinds of things I like to do, which are photography and travel, but also a lot of adventuring, mountaineering, skiing, mountain biking, backpacking, trekking, all of that kind of stuff. So I see myself, being on the road a lot more. And if I've done it well, we'll see. 10 years from now, I'd like to be in a place where I'm kind of retired. So like I said, I'm not really doing anything differently. I'm still taking photos and teaching and doing all that stuff. It just doesn't matter anymore.
Doing only the things that you want to do, not necessarily things that you kind of have to do in some cases, possibly.
Exactly. And if I want to go teach somewhere or speak at a conference or work on a photography project or take a photo trip, it won't need to be about whether it's going to pencil out or not. That would be amazing to feel like.
And you can do all the out of Chicago events. That's great.
Just do them all perfect.
That was supposed to be the correct answer, by the way. Them for free. Yes, even better. That's perfect. Yes. Great answer. All right. Great way to end. All right. So where can people come and see your work and find these tutorials and all that?
So my website is outdoorexposurephoto.com, or you can just Google Sean Bagshaw and you'll get there eventually. And of course, you can find me on all the various social media platforms, or most of them anyways, being active out there. And I really like to use social media socially and try to interact with people and communicate with people. That's the main reason why I enjoy it. And then also photocascadia.com. Definitely check out photocascadia.com. It's a great collection of images there from 7 different photographers. So I think that's a kind of a cool one-stop place to look at a lot of photos. But also I would say really check it out for that archive of, articles that we've been writing for the past 10 years.
That's awesome. I think the kids finally got home from soccer. I think it's time to wrap up the podcast.
Right on, right on.
Parker, can you say hi to Mr. Sean?
Hi.
Hey, Parker, how's it going?
Oh, yeah, I forgot. He can't hear.
Oh, he can't hear you. He's still here in your headphones. He wants to know how Parker. Good to see you, man.
That's funny. I forgot he can't hear anything. It's in my headphones. All right. Thank you so much, Sean, for doing this. Can't wait to see you in Acadia and follow everything you're doing online. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. I always enjoy chatting with you, whatever the situation. I'm looking forward to Acadia. And yeah, I look forward to the next chance we get to have a chat.
All right. Can't wait. Thank you, Sean. Bye-bye.
Take care.
F8, The Photographer's Perspective is hosted by me, Chris Smith, and produced by Out of Chicago. A special thanks to all photographers that share their inside knowledge to make this possible. We release a new episode each week, so be sure to subscribe to the show wherever podcasts are found. To learn more about Out of Chicago and upcoming events, go to outofchicago.com. Subscribe to our mailing list to stay connected and be the first to know of our next new location where you can shoot side by side with the pros.